The first thing I wanted to know is what kind of right did Star India base its claim on? Because as far as I understand it, it's not copyright or any other recognized form of intellectual property right in India.
Yes, you understand correctly. You know, they Star filed the suit and, you know, vehemently stated that they're not claiming copyright. And, you know, that was, in fact, partly the confusion that we faced before the single judge in the first round. What they did file the suit for was the thought of unfair competition, the alleged thought of unfair competition, I should say. It eventually broadened into three separate claims arising out of the same facts, which was unfair competition, unjust enrichment, and commercial misappropriation. So the argument was that, look, this is the cricket scores and match updates are our property or our quasi-property. And while we may not be able to stop the world at large from commercializing it, we can stop those who sort of use it for their commercial benefit and, you know, in a manner which detriments them. So the claim was that of unfair competition, essentially.
Okay, I understand that there is some history in the United States, something called the Hot News Doctrine. Do you want to speak about that?
Yes. In fact, that is the principal case on which their entire claim was based. And if you see the plaint, it's precisely, you know, on those lines that they've prepared their claim. You know, which is why I said later, you know, the case broadened into unjust enrichment and commercial misappropriation. In principle, fundamentally, the case, their claim was on that of unfair competition as laid down by the United States Supreme Court in 1980 in the INS case. Basically, what happened there was that there were two competing news agencies. And, you know, there was because there's a significant difference in time between the West Coast and the East Coast, what was happening was that, one newspaper agency would publish news on the East Coast, and, their competitors on the West Coast would lift that and publish it on the West Coast and, you know, get that kind of advantage. And often they would publish it at the same time or in advance of the party that was actually collecting the information. So the matter went right up to the Supreme Court there, and the Supreme Court held that, look, you have to be mindful that at that time the Copyright Act of 1976, the U.S. Copyright Act, wasn't in place. So there were copyright laws, but they understood that they can't claim copyright here because it's the fact that they're trying to protect. And more than facts is their investment in the effort which has gone into gathering these facts. So they said that, look, you know, if somebody's spending so much effort and time and energy and investment to collect these facts, it's not fair if somebody else is able to just sort of bodily lift them and commercialize it to the detriment of the person who's generating these facts or collecting them. So they sort of said that there should be a time lag which should be imposed on the defendant over there. So as to, you know, just set the, on principles of equity. So that's the principle which they sought to sort of bring in here. Now, that case has been tried and tested subsequently in the U.S. itself in the context of sports. And eventually there's been a body of law which sort of, you know, sort of dissociates from that judgment rather than follows it. In fact, even lower courts have tried to distinguish it and said that, look, it's restricted to its peculiar facts. We shouldn't use it as a principle of law and, you know, just restrict it to time difference and all those aspects which made it, you know, a known specific kind of case.
You are talking about the Motorola judgment.
Motorola is one of them, but, you know, in fact, right from 1929... this case called Cheney Brothers. That's when, you know, somebody tried to use that principle in the context of fabrics. And somebody said, look, you know, I'm making these fabrics and they're time sensitive in the sense that you can only, you know, they're popular only for a season. This is 1929 we're talking about. So they said, look, it's popular only for a season and, you know, it can't really get any sort of statutory protection. So please apply the same principles there and stop my competitors from lifting it. you know, and the court there said it was a federal district circuit court, and they said that look, INS, of course, if we take it to be a precedent and you know a law that the Supreme Court intended to lay down, then yes, you would be covered. But we don't think that the Supreme Court intended to do that. The Supreme Court was dealing with a very specific kind of scenario. And, you know, they did criticize the judgment to a certain extent. They relied on Justice's Brandeis. He was the popular dissent in the INS case of 1918. And they relied on that to say that, you know, that case should be restricted to its own circumstances. And you can't create new rights in the manner, the court was, of course, mindful that they're talking about a Supreme Court judgment, and, you know, they did put it mildly. But, you know, so right from 1929, there's been a departure from that position in the United States itself. And then subsequently, of course, there was Motorola, and there was Fly on the Wall, and all these cases, which sort of, you know, even whittled it down further.
All right. Coming to India, what implications do you think this division bench judgment of the Delhi High Court has for the sports broadcasting industry and sports media rights in general?
In many ways, the judgment translates, you know, beyond just the sports arena. But within sports, what it does is it recognizes and discusses what rights an organizer of a sporting event should have. And it recognizes that there's no such thing as owning an event. You can't own, because the BCCI organizes a cricket match does not mean they own the cricket match. You own elements of that cricket match which the statute or which law recognizes that you should own. Whatever rights you have will stem from what law, you know, sort of awards to you. And from that perspective, you know, and that was our argument before the division bench. What we had said that, look, you have control over the land. You have rented a stadium, so you have control over the land. So you can prevent people from entering that land. And while entering, you impose restrictions on them, and that's how that's a contract-based restriction. So people who enter your property, you can impose restrictions on carrying of cameras and broadcasts or any kind of restrictions you want to impose. That's one aspect. The second aspect is that even if you don't have a contractual relationship, then if you're looking at rights in REM, then you're looking at what property rights the statutes have granted you. So if you say that, look, my cricket players are performers within the Copyright Act, so then you can say that there is some sort of statutory protection on their performance. And so if there's any contract being present, you can't record my performers or broadcast them, you know, what they're doing. So, you know, that's the two manners in which rights are owned by an organizer of a sporting event. One is statutory and second is contract. And there's no third thing outside of it. So what examples we gave, which in fact are recognized in, you know, Australian judgments, UK judgments, something like that, is that any kind of event which would in fact require investment, will generate a lot of ancillary commercial opportunities. So for instance, you have races taking place in Greater Noida. You will have taxi services, you know, specifically geared to take people to the track in Greater Noida. Similarly, you have a match going on. You will have a whole number of vendors outside of the venue, stadium, selling, Pepsi, popcorn, things like that. You know, they may not be allowed inside the venue because they may not be the official sponsors. So again, we come back to the control over the land. But outside the stadium, they can generate money based on the event which the other person is organizing. So there's nothing unfair about it. There's no such thing as unfair competition. You know, there can be a popcorn vendor selling popcorn outside the stadium. You can't take an argument that but for my investment, this event would never have taken place. So please don't commercialize on my investment. You know, this does take us back to principles of tandem, sign, and jury and things. You know, those very fundamental principles of law where you may, in fact, be suffering some monetary loss. But there is no right to profit. You have to show that there's a legal right, you know. BCCI could have assigned to Star the exclusive right to sell popcorn. that doesn't mean that Star is able to go and go to court excluding other parties from selling popcorn outside the stadium. That is not a law legally recognized right. So from that perspective, the judgment is very useful to determine the bounds of the rights a sports organization has. So notwithstanding what BCCI's contract with Star would say, there are only certain elements of rights which BCCI could assign to Star. And that's what would translate to all kind of sporting organizations in India.